This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A lot of people who run schools in the U.S. are nervous. There's new leadership in Washington and an education department that seems to have turned away from local public schools in favor of charters and privatization. Then there are the endless standardized tests.
Raising test scores has become a proxy for everything from improving learning to addressing very real social ills.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a pair of educators who have decades of experience running and teaching in public schools, who say these schools belong to you and me. Then we'll spend an academic minute deciding if Wikipedia has a place in the classroom. I'm Bob Barron, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The new administration in Washington has some educators worried. They feel that with Betsy DeVos as education secretary, public schools in the U.S. will take a back seat to privatization and charter schools. That's the focus of the new book, These Schools Belong to You and Me, Why We Can't Afford to Abandon Our Public Schools. Here to talk about the book and the state of public education in the U.S. are the authors. Deborah Meyer taught elementary school for 40 years and was the founder of the Mission Hill School, a pilot school in Boston. Emily Gasoy was a founding teacher at the Mission Hill School and now is an adjunct at Georgetown University. Before we started talking about the book, I asked Emily to talk a bit about that place they both have in common, the Mission Hill School.
Well, I'm glad you asked that because this is its 20th anniversary. This September was the 20th year of the school. And we met when I actually applied to be an assistant teacher because I only had 2 years of experience, and I had heard that Deb only hired teachers with 3 years of experience. So I thought I will get in and then eventually hopefully become a full classroom teacher. But I was hired as the third grade teacher there, and there were really only about seven or eight of us to start, and that was by design because one of the really important principles of that, you know, in Deb's 30 years of doing this work, she has found that schools really need to be small if people are going to be able to have meaningful conversations together. And that's so essential to democratically governed schools.
And what was it about that school that made it special?
We got very special status. We were a public school in Boston. And Boston at that time was, in fact, all choice, based on desegregation orders that went back to the 70s, I believe. So we were another school that was started. A whole bunch of them were started to be piloting the idea of greater autonomy. And we were all members of the union. And the union, in fact, proposed this idea of trying to see how much autonomy would make sense for schools to have. So there are now about 30 of these pilots in Boston that have autonomy over most operating questions. The salary is part of the union contract, certain aspects of working conditions, and of course we're a public school, so safety and, you know, a lot of things are out of our hands, but most of the things that matter to teachers and parents, the pilot schools can decide on site. That was what was special.
And, well, let's come up to the future now. Why this book? Why now?
I think a couple of reasons. One is that public education as we know it is under threat now. And, you know, we started writing this book before the 2016 election, and that was one of the motivators at that time, too. But now more than ever, now that we have a Secretary of Education who has no experience in public education at all and whose experience really is limited to her interest in privatizing public education, we think this book is very relevant because it's a book about what's possible in terms of having schools that are more explicitly in the service of democracy, but also just the importance of public schools and public institutions more broadly to our democracy.
And I think we have been very lucky to have remained, to have held on to as many democratic features as we have, given that I think we never really used our public school system to help people understand democracy and know how to operate in a democratic system. It's very top-down. Neither principals nor teachers in most public schools have a great deal of authority. so that we too often say to kids, the reason we have to do this is because we have to do it, because someone told us we had to do it. And I don't think children should be spending 16 years in schools in which the adults that they know best, their families and their teachers, have so little control over what life is like in the institutions that they presumably run.
You use the word democracy a lot, and in the book you talk about democratic education. How do you define that for somebody? What is democratic education?
That's a good question.
Yeah, very good question.
We need to see it in action to understand it, because it's not an easy idea. It doesn't just mean majority rule, but it means that everybody, of, for, by the people, to try to maximize the voice of everybody in society, a voice that is heard and has some power, that all the people have power. That's the idea. Then it's trying to figure out how do you go about that and what are the trade-offs you have to make so that we have both freedom, but we have freedom for everybody.
There's a lot of rhetoric recently about, or not so recently, over the last probably couple of decades around that there's overemphasis on the needs of teachers and not, you know, on the needs of students. And the idea that you could have a culture where you're not attending to the needs of both, where, you know, teachers are not modeling for students sort of what it means to be somebody who has a voice is sort of ludicrous. And so there's actually a quote by a developmental psychologist who's very influential in education, Lev Vygotsky. He said, children grow into the intellectual life of those around them. And I think it's a really apt quote right now because it captures both the importance of creating a vibrant intellectual life for both the adults that children are keeping company with. And so a major part of democratic education is having vibrant intellectual communities where both the adults and the students and the parents as well sort of feel like they're part of something that matters, that they're part of something that they have a say in and that they feel sort of a shared sense of belonging and responsibility for.
There are many complicated trade-offs in a democracy, depending on what's more important, what's crucial facing you, that you're willing to give up something X in order to get Y sometimes, but that requires a community that can also revise its decisions, can make a decision one day and then 2 years later decide that didn't work. So if to simplify a school so that young people can also, just the word that Emily used, keep company with the kind of citizenship and citizens that we hope they'll be themselves.
It's something you more demonstrate than teach.
Yes. You know, there are times you stop and are direct teaching, but like we've discovered in general, that the most effective teacher is experience. Baseball is a good example. If you've never seen a baseball game played, try to explain it to somebody. And democracy is even more complicated than baseball.
A little bit.
Not only is it hard to understand something if you don't see the flaws, because democracy will never be perfect. And if we don't understand even the flaws, makes sense. Well, we did that. That's true. That wasn't a great idea in some ways, but it was the only way at the time we could figure out how to do something else, and which we thought was more important. You have to see how rules in life in general, how they develop, and when they're counterproductive and need to change. But that the process is complicated unless you've seen it and know it works.
And I would just add one other thing, which is that there's such an emphasis, and this has probably always been true, but perhaps more now than ever, on fixing schools or, you know, finding a solution that is a fix. And that is really counter to what Deb has just spoken about, this idea that the process and the process that happens on the ground among the practitioners and the students and the families who are closest to the action, that is where decisions need to be made, because that's where it's understood where what works today may not be what we need to do tomorrow.
And at the same time in which we have to figure out how to do that on one hand, how to make decisions that makes sense in that particular locality by the people who have to carry it out, while also keeping some commonalities across the country about what's permissible and not permissible. So there's, even there, there are decisions that we have to carry out about health and safety that we have to carry out because they are the law of the land, or they're constitutional principles about free speech or separation of church and state. So finding the balance between the law of the land or the state or the community itself, the political community, and the constituents of the school itself, that is another complicated balance. And I don't know of any absolute principle for deciding that. We have to play with it.
Still to come, our conversation with Deborah Meyer and Dr. Emily Gassoy continues with a look at how to solve the issues they see in U.S. schools today. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are Deborah Meyer, a retired elementary school teacher and founder of the Mission Hill School in Boston, and Emily Gassoy, a founding teacher at the Mission Hill School and now an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. We're talking about their new book, These Schools Belong to You and Me, Why We Can't Afford to Abandon Our Public Schools.
Well, if you open up the book, you see the first chapter is called The Problem and Promise of Public Education. And I could just sit here and say, okay, well, tell me, what are the problem, what are the promise? And I think we could fill a week right there. But in a nutshell, what is the promise and the problem of public education?
I think one of the...
Well, that was a whole chapter, Emily, and if we could say it in two sentences.
I know. Well, I would say one of the major problems that probably has... It's been a problem for a long time, but again, you know, it has ramped up in the last 20 years of reform, is an over-reliance on numeric data and over-reliance on testing, which has narrowed curriculum and taken decision-making away from principals and teachers. It's distorted what we have come to think of as high-quality schools, high-quality teaching, and even learning. And raising test scores has become a proxy for everything from improving learning to addressing very real social ills such as poverty and racism. And really, it's funny because, especially in the last few years, there's been pretty widespread acknowledgement that tests are at best inadequate at measuring any of those things. And yet, I think we are so entrenched in or so dependent on numeric data that they continue to sort of put the cart before the horse, if you will, in terms of decisions that are made about what's best for education and how we go about making improvements.
There are some things that are very easy to translate into numeric terms, how large the school is, what the attendance is, and I think those are very useful data. Test scores are a particularly deceptive instrument, and what they do not tell you is about what they claim to tell you. That's the dilemma. The design of standardized testing actually, if carried out properly, cannot show improvement because there will always be one kid at the end of the line, and one kid at the beginning, and 10% in the last 10%. So if you're trying to get comparative scores, which is what they are trying to get in standardized tests, if you're comparing people to each other, there will always be the exact same number of people in the bottom 50% and the top 50%. And it's not easy to find questions that will sort people properly. That was the problem of the IQ test, and it's the problem we're now facing with standardized tests. And it's been true for, and it's been exposed over and over again. So some things are hard to decide by test scores. Think of all the things, the jury system. We don't have a test to decide whether someone is guilty or not. We leave it to the judgment of a rather random sample of people. And that's what we're in a way proposing, that the school become a jury. And we assess schools by using the jury approach. We bring together people who we think we trust and, as experts, and who have relatively no self-interest, direct self-interest in the school, who come and visit the school, look at the school, interview people, and develop a statement to the community about what they see as the strengths and weaknesses of a school. But we rely on judgment because, in fact, that's what democracy relies on. It's hard sometimes to remember that democracy rests on the idea that people do have special interests and biases and different experiences, but we're relying in the end on collective judgment. And I think we should use that principle for assessing schools. And as long as we don't, we're fooling ourselves.
They certainly don't do anything to close the real gap between students with privilege and students who are living in low-income communities. Nothing substantive, anyway.
I would just say that that's what we think, I think, is the serious problem with public education in America.
In the book, you use the term authentic accountability as opposed to high-stakes accountability. What is authentic accountability, and is it being tried?
Yes. There are 30 high schools, for example, in New York City, who belong to a consortium that graduate from New York City, New York State, with approval of the state on the basis of what I call authentic assessments rather than test scores. They don't take the region's tests. It's more like a PhD. They present work they have done to a panel of people who include outside experts, and on the basis of defending that work, the committee decides whether or not they have passed that entry into the next step, which is that you're a high school graduate. So they have a series of things that all students must do, and we do the same thing at Mission Hill to graduate children from the eighth grade. They present in seven different areas, maybe six now, to a committee of six or seven people that includes someone from the family, includes outside experts, and it includes faculty members. Each defense takes about 45 minutes to an hour, and they do six of them in the course of their seventh and eighth grade to demonstrate that they're ready for high school. And the work that they do is kept and can be seen and revisited by other people to see whether they think our standards are good standards. We videotape some of them also so that we have a record of what our judgment is based on. And we also do the same thing for the school. The pilot schools in Boston are visited every 5 years by an outside committee that the city puts together. They come and spend a week at the school, talking and visiting and observing classes. They write a report. The community responds to their report, and then they make any revisions if it seems called for, and they present that to the superintendent and the school board. There is no way to evaluate that doesn't have some areas of bias. People bring their experience with them. But it's very open and transparent, which tests are not. And people can question it, and people can argue with it, and we can change it.
And I would say that one of the examples we give in the book is a statewide alternative assessment that is being piloted in New Hampshire called PACE. They're, I think, in their third or fourth year of it. And they are trying to only have standardized tests once at the elementary and once at the high school level. And so students go for most of their elementary and high school career without having standardized tests. And in place of that, schools and entire districts can opt in. They're phasing this in. And teachers and school leaders work with state guidelines to create assessments that are directly connected to the actual learning that the students are doing in their classrooms. So again, I think that's an important piece of the authentic, why we call it authentic.
Deborah, you wrote in 2002 about four key conditions a good school could have, but you've abandoned one of those conditions, which was choice.
Yeah,
why is that?
Sometimes you are thinking about one problem in which choice was very useful, and in thinking about that, you forget that there's a danger on the other side. So when I was primarily thinking about how could I demonstrate that a school that was like the private school that I was lucky enough to go to as a child would work wonderfully for low-income minority children. For that reason, though, I thought we would need a choice, because if parents were forced to send their children to a school that didn't look like the kind of school they were used to, as they would feel they were being experimented on. So I very self-centeredly wanted choice for my little experiment. But on the other hand, choice has some serious problems in terms of segregating people into enclaves of like-minded people. That makes democracy easier, which is what I wanted to make it, but it doesn't make democracy stronger.
Looking ahead, are we getting better? Is there hope on the horizon?
I don't think so. But I never knew what was going to come next. The 1950s were not like the 1940s, and I was surprised. And the 1960s weren't at all like the 1950s, and I was surprised. So maybe I'll be surprised. But I think while there are a lot of good examples of schooling in America that really demonstrate our point, we are moving in the other direction at the moment.
Deborah Meyer is a retired 40-year elementary school teacher and founder of the Mission Hill School in Boston. And Emily Gasoy is a founding teacher at the Mission Hill School and now an adjunct at Georgetown University. Their new book is called These Schools Belong to You and Me, Why We Can't Afford to Abandon Our Public Schools. Okay, let's all just admit it. We've all used Wikipedia more than once in the past. But should it be used in the classroom? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Should you use Wikipedia in the classroom? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Zachary McDowell, assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Chicago, discusses this common question.
According to a recent study from Stanford University, quote, young people's ability to reason about the information on the internet can be summed up in one word, bleak, end quote. Students read Wikipedia every day, but they're often told, don't use it. Abstinence-only Wikipedia education simply doesn't work. Wikipedia is an incredible teaching tool and resource to learn critical information literacy skills, to motivate students, to learn writing for a general audience, and to learn about the class topic. Those of us teaching with Wikipedia have had plenty of anecdotal evidence to support the Wikipedia assignment, but we needed empirical evidence to support our hypotheses. I recently teamed up with the Wiki Education Foundation to study student learning outcomes using Wikipedia assignments. Results confirmed what we'd been seeing for years. Students were proud of their work, spent more time, were more motivated, and were more satisfied with their class assignment than with traditional assignments. Both students and instructors valued Wikipedia assignments more for learning digital literacy, critical thinking, learning to write for the general public, and learning about the reliability of online sources. Not only did students perceive the assignments as useful for developing these needed skills, they also demonstrated mastery in these skills. Students engaged in deep learning about systemic biases, construction of information, and value of information. As one student participant in a focus group said, quote, it raises an awareness of what is good information and what is bad information. You have much more of a questioning mentality, and you're a lot more conscious of the validity of information that you read. End quote. If nothing else, we definitely need more students thinking like this.
That was Zachary McDowell of the University of Illinois at Chicago. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOO Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.